I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Winston Churchill had a lot to deal with, an Iron Curtain over Europe, leading a nation through World War II, and the possibility of extraterrestrial life? Today we'll find out more about the British Bulldog's scientific side through rediscovered essays the renowned politician wrote about the environment, the human body, and aliens, no less. Then the life and music of jazz legend John Coltrane. We'll speak with the writer and director of Chasing Train. The documentary traces the saxophonist's career in music, a life that lasted only 40 years. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Winston Churchill looms large in the political annals of British and world history. Best remembered for his leadership as Prime Minister during World War II, it seems he was always in politics. But there was a time when Churchill was without a seat in Parliament. The wilderness years of 1929 to 1940 saw the great statesman, who had always been a prolific writer, producing books and magazine articles as his primary source of income. In 1939, he composed three essays, not about politics or the Nazis. Each essay had a scientific theme: the systems of the body, evolution, and extraterrestrial life. He revised them in the 1950s and at some point submitted them to his publisher, Emery Reeves. Those pages ended up in four boxes that Reeves' widow donated to the National Churchill Museum at Westminster College in Fulton, Missouri, the location for Sir Winston's famous Iron Curtain speech. To pick up the story from there, we're joined by Timothy Riley. He's the chief curator of the National Churchill Museum and the man who rediscovered the essays. He joins us by phone from Wisconsin. And Timothy, nice to have you.
Thanks, Steve. It's great to be on.
Your field is art history. So how did you end up finding these in the archives? Because it was almost by happenstance, wasn't it?
Yes, I was actually working on a project. Winston Churchill was a painter, and we were doing a large exhibition featuring Churchill's paintings, and I was consulting the archive, looking for materials about Churchill, the painter, and I came across three typewritten essays that were, had the titles of the essays and, by the Right Honorable Winston S. Churchill on the cover page. I was intrigued. I set them aside, knowing that I'd come back to them eventually, and I did so. And what we found was an extraordinary look at Churchill and his interest in science.
Well, these essays were on typewritten pages, so how did you know they actually were written by Sir Winston?
Well, we cross-referenced. The essays that are in the National Churchill Museum archive at Westminster College in Missouri are versions of essays that are also in the depository at the University of Cambridge in England, the Churchill Center archives there. The first drafts of those essays were published in 1939, so I was quite confident as I compared the drafts that this was a bona fide Churchill writing. And, of course, these were essays that were in the property of his literary agent, Emery Reeves. So it was a good bet that they were by Churchill.
Well, why and when did Mrs. Reeves donate these boxes?
Well, she wanted to remember her husband's legacy. She was American, and she had ties with Winston Churchill. When Churchill retired after his second premiership in the 1950s, he spent over 100 days a year at the villa in the south of France that the Reeves owned, and wrote extensively, painted also, and was very, very close to the Reeves in the 1950s later in life. So it was a natural fit that she memorialized her husband with giving those papers to the college and the museum.
Were the contents inventoried and, cataloged at the time?
Sure, yes. Like we do with all of our papers, they were cataloged and inventory. They were finding aids, they've just been languishing so much in the boxes, waiting for someone to look at them. And I happen to, by complete happenstance, stumble across them.
I was going to say, do you think it's unusual that no one going through the contents then recognized how remarkable the essays were in light of the author who wrote them?
Well, you know, there are a lot of scientists and Churchillians, or historians, who have scoured Churchill's interest in science. Most of the time they focus on his curiosity with the nuclear threat that Churchill was very keenly interested in. And a lot of the research is directed in that area. So when I think, you know, I'm quite sure that other scholars have seen these and also set them aside, waiting to come back to them later. And, well, later has arrived, I suppose.
You know, I always associate Winston Churchill with, you know, matters of state and important things, so it's a little hard to wrap my head around him contemplating alien life. When you read them, what was your first impression? I mean, do you think he'd gone off the tracks a little bit here?
No, I think it's very characteristic of Churchill's personality. He was an intensely curious person, read voraciously. I mean, he read Darwin's Origin of Species. He knew Species. He knew H.G. Wells. He was keenly interested in how things worked and how different components, related to one another. It was, I think, a great hallmark of his mind that he was curious about so many subjects. So science. It didn't surprise me that Churchill would take this on. And he, in the essay "Are We Alone in the Universe," he asks one of the biggest questions that we've been asking for millennia. Are we alone? And he answers that question remarkably using the scientific method. He outlines for us that if there's going to be life, what do you need? Well, we need water. Well, what do we need to have water? We need a climate. And a temperature that will exist such that water won't be frozen or gaseous, and so forth. And then he narrows it down to speculating that there must be planets like Earth that have habitable zones. He reasons this very clearly in a scientific way to come to the conclusion that, of all the planets and all of the stars in this vast universe, it's hard to fathom that we are not alone or we're the only ones. Hmm. It's a remarkable, remarkable observation.
To your knowledge, were any of these essays ever published?
They were published in different forms. They were originally penned in 1939. Our version was revised slightly. In fact, the "Are We Alone in the Universe" essay was originally entitled "Are We Alone in Space." Churchill changed the title in the 1950s, and a smaller, shortened version of the essay was actually published in 1943 during the war, it was published with the name "Are There Men in the Moon?" Believe it or not, but they were originally penned in 1939, and unpublished when he wrote them, which was unusual. Churchill spent the 1930s writing voraciously. It was a source of income for him. Mm-hmm. For them to be set aside and not published in 1939 is somewhat unusual. But at least the essay about direct extraterrestrial life was picked up in the 1940s and published in a shorter version, but never in its full form.
So bottom line, you don't find it all that out of place that Sir Winston Churchill would have turned his attention to matters of science even in 1939 as Adolf Hitler was on his rise in Europe.
That's the remarkable thing about Winston Churchill. The more you study Winston Churchill and the deeper you get into his life and his legacy and aftermath of his life, you almost smile and say, there he goes again. He speculates. He actually ends the "Are We Alone in the Universe" essay by saying that, "I am, for one, not so immensely impressed by the success we are making of our civilization here." Again, this is 1939. He's not impressed by the civilization here, to think that we're the only ones here. I think it's telling. He's observing the Nazi march into Europe and saying, we're not doing it well. Perhaps there are other agencies out there in the vast universe that are also there, that may ultimately, perhaps my speculation, be ones that we can look to for inspiration.
Well, what else might surprise a reader of "Are We Alone in the Universe" that might take them aback in terms of some of Winston Churchill's conclusions here?
Well, I think again, he he digested his the advice from his scientific advisors. You know, he knew H.G. Wells. Frederick Lindemann, a great physicist, was a good friend and advisor. And he digested the science and was able to communicate it in a way that we can all understand. Churchill was, above all, a master of words and phrases, and he uses his talents as a writer to make these scientific concepts and these big questions very accessible in article form. These were intended to be written in the newspapers, and I think that Churchill's ability to communicate these concepts, these scientific concepts, to a mass audience is remarkable and characteristic of his style of communication and talent with words.
We're visiting with Timothy Riley. He's the chief curator of the National Churchill Museum, about some rediscovered essays that Winston Churchill wrote back in the 30s, revised in the 50s, about alien life on other planets. You know, I'm trying to imagine what readers in the 1950s would have thought of the great Sir Winston Churchill saying there was the possibility of extraterrestrial life out there.
You know, it's hard to say. I think that... Churchill's interest in science served him well, not only in asking the big question about extraterrestrial life, but this is a man who, in World War I, saw the horrific warfare in the trenches and wanted to find ways of making war be concluded more quickly. He conceived of, with others, and invented the tank, invested in airplanes, knowing that. Full well that science could if properly harnessed do good and Churchill's I think oftentimes seen as a great war leader, but he wanted to avoid war and he wanted to use the tools of science, radar for instance, for defense, to end war more quickly. So that's another characteristic of Churchill that is in keeping with these essays and his natural curiosity about science.
You know, the other two essays here, Mysteries of the Body and Rivers, River of Life, what do they look at and how well did Winston grasp the complexities of those topics?
Sure. Well, it's funny. One of the first things I did when I rediscovered the essays was, I knew that they weren't published in 1939, and I wondered if they weren't published because maybe the science was off. So I shared the essays with a couple of faculty members at Westminster College in the biology department, the Mystery of the Body essay and the River of Life, which deals with evolution. And the science faculty were unanimous in saying this: his science is spot on. In fact, he's doing great work in the 1930s for a statesman. It's remarkable that a statesman would tackle the topic of evolution, for instance, and just do so with great accuracy, demonstrated that he knew Darwin and Darwin's writing very well. Churchill did. I was very pleased to get. I'm not a scientist by training, but to get professional scientists to validate Churchill's findings, and River of Life is a wonderful outline of evolution, evolutionary theory following Darwin. Mystery of the Body, it's entitled. I like to say that if you're studying for an AP exam in biology about how the human body works, and you read this essay, you'll probably get an A on the test. it's a great essay about the body systems and so forth.
You know, what kind of writer is he? You know, given what a prolific writer he was, and so highly regarded. I mean, as you read these manuscripts, are there lots of words crossed out and markings and edit marks all over the place? Or does he write pretty much, does it flow out his fingertips and onto the page and it stays pretty much that way?
Well, for the most part, Churchill dictated. He spoke aloud.
Of course he did. Yeah.
Secretaries, who did the difficult work for him. Oftentimes writing late into the night. Churchillian hours are such that he would perhaps finish working at 2 o'clock in the morning. He had a team of assistants and secretaries helping him with those revisions and so forth. But he was very, very particular about words. You can see in other speeches, the Iron Curtain speech. We have a draft of the Iron Curtain speech, which he gave in Fulton. We have the, all it was the draft that was 2 days before the speech, and at the last second he's crossing out words or changing the order and ramping up the rhetoric. It's incredible to see his mind at work and making sure that every word, every syllable, every consonant, every phrase is well balanced for full effect. In fact, I discovered this the same thing that he did in painting, with shadow and light and color. Mm. He paints with words, and he was a master painter with words. Edward R. Murrow, the great journalist, said that during the war, Winston Churchill mobilized the English language and sent it into battle. I think that's true.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And I think that's also true for his writing. He won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1953. People forget that. So he certainly had a gift.
There's a question of copyright when it comes to these essays, Timothy. How many parties are involved with getting all that straightened out?
Well, right now we're working with some attorneys and lawyers because parts of these essays were published because the Churchill family still has a stake in Churchill's papers. We want to make sure that we have a full agreement from all parties involved. But our hope is that before the end of this year, we'll be able to publish them in their full form and share them with the world. And I think it'll be a great thing when we accomplish that task.
Is there some question whether or not the museum will be able to keep the essays?
No, not at all. I mean, these essays are in our collection and have been and will continue to be. In fact, the Are We Alone in the Universe essay, it's a 10-page essay, and six of those pages are on view right now. If you go to Fulton into the Clementine Spencer Churchill Library, you'll see a display case with the original typewritten pages in it, and the people can see for themselves this remarkable essay.
That's from the Are We Alone in the Universe essay, right?
Correct.
Are there plans to put the other two essays on display at some point down the road?
Yes, I think we'll rotate them. It's been a very popular subject, and when we first announced these, and Mario Livio, great astrophysicist, published an article in the British journal Nature in February that the story went viral, the world paid attention. I think that we've learned that there's a great demand for Churchill and his interest in science. So we'll rotate the rest of the essays and display over the course of the next year or two.
That's Timothy Riley. He's director and chief curator of the National Churchill Museum, located on the campus of Westminster College in Fulton, Missouri. And Timothy, thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Steve. I appreciate it.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about the life and times of jazz legend John Coltrane. He's the subject of a new documentary opening up this weekend in Kansas City. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday, we spoke with the author of a new biography of Richard Nixon. You can find that conversation online at kcur.org/up-to-date. On Monday's show, we speak with White House reporter Paul Brandis and find out how extreme weather shifts are affecting water quality. Well, when it comes to the titans of jazz, John Coltrane's name is always mentioned near the top. He was a man groomed by Dizzy Gillespie and Miles Davis, but who then became a spiritual life force of his own with his classic quartet of the 1960s. In a new documentary that opens today in Kansas City, President Bill Clinton says you can recognize a John Coltrane piece with just a few notes. He was that singular a stylist. In case you're new to John Coltrane, here he is on his classic Giant Steps. Thank you. The new documentary is titled Chasing Train. It opens today at the Tivoli, and joining us now from Los Angeles is the film's writer and director, John Scheinfeld. And John, so nice to have you. Good morning.
Nice to be with you, Steve. Thanks so much.
Well, why did you want to make a film on John Coltrane?
Well, I will confess to you that when I was asked if I wanted to make this documentary, that I was not an obsessed Coltrane fan. I'd been introduced to his music, like many people, through his recording of My Favorite Things. And so I knew it. And then I came to know and love A Love Supreme. But I really knew very little about the man himself. So I went off and I did some research. And the more I read about his life, the more convinced I became that this was a very unique and special story. We all know the cliche of the young artist who comes from nowhere and has great talent, explodes on the scene, has great success, makes a lot of money, abuses substances, and dies young. We all know that story. There was a documentary about a year and some ago about Amy Winehouse, who's very much that story. But to me, Coltrane was the antithesis of that story. Yes, he had his challenges early on, but it's when he overcame them that he really ascended, that he really started on the road to becoming the iconic figure that we know. He did things the right way. And to me, that's a very uplifting an inspiring story, and that's the one I wanted to tell.
You know, it's so interesting because he was so much more than just another saxophone player. You know, his fans talk endlessly about this spiritual quality to his music, and that reflected the man who he was.
Without question. At the heart of our film is his spiritual journey. And when we say spiritual, we don't mean any specific religion. He began in the Methodist faith. Both of his grandfathers were ministers. But then he fell far from the tree for a period of years. And it's when he kicked his addiction that he reconnected with that spiritual journey. And the journey took many different forms. And he read the Bible. He read the Quran. He read the Kabbalah. He read texts in Buddhist texts, Hindu, Shinto. In many ways, Coltrane was like a sponge for ideas. He was an avid reader, absorbed many, many different concepts and thoughts, and that came out through his horn in a very unique approach to music. And Steve, I don't know how many musicians you've read about that claim Albert Einstein as an influence, and Coltrane did. He read Einstein. He was very much concerned with issues of why are we here and what are we doing and what is our purpose and what is the universe. And he was just a remarkable human being in that respect.
You know, in the early 1950s, John, he managed to catch on with a guy named Dizzy Gillespie. Why was that such a big break for a young John Coltrane?
Well, I think for any young musician, to be able to play with, learn from, again, this sponge effect, absorb from, another iconic artist, that is going to help move your own vision, your own art forward. And he started with Dizzy in 1949, and Dizzy was arguably one of the top musicians in the jazz world at that time. And to be with him really helped advance Coltrane's technical abilities as a player. And I think in general, Coltrane was very fortunate in that effect. He talks a lot about how he had still had much to learn. And I think he looked at his career very much as a musical education. And every step of the way, even if he was in some bad bands, which he was, there was something to learn, but you sort of take a quantum leap when you're with someone as brilliant and talented as Dizzy Gillespie.
You know, at one point, Gillespie kicked him out of the band along with another well-known sax player named Jimmy Heath. Why did that happen?
Well, as I said just a couple minutes ago, he had his challenges, and the challenge was heroin. He, at a young age, at about 22, was in this world of jazz musicians, and for some there was this mistaken notion that somehow hard drugs would help your art, would help your playing, would help your career. And he fell into that. And one night in Chicago, he and Jimmy Heath were shooting up in the basement of the theater where Dizzy's band was playing, and Dizzy happened to come upon them, saw them, and fired them. And Coltrane begged his way back in, stayed for another few months, but the drugs continued to be an issue. And but he was not at that time ready to do anything about it. And in fact, the drugs would continue to dog him for about another 6 years.
You know, John Coltrane practiced endlessly, and I mean endlessly. Why, and what impact did that have on his playing?
Well, we've used the word already this morning, obsessed, and I think I would come back to that word.
Mm-hmm.
Coltrane was obsessed with being the best player that he could. And the people that knew him best that I interview in the film, people like Sonny Rollins, Benny Golson, Jimmy Heath, Wayne Shorter, McCoy Tyner, Reggie Workman, all of these people were around Coltrane for a long time, and they all describe very keenly how practicing was so important to him. That Jimmy Heath tells the story in the film that they'd be up in the hotel and he'd be practicing late at night until people in the other rooms in the hotel would be yelling, "Hey, you know, shut up." And he'd stop blowing, but he would still finger the horn, still finger his movements as if he were blowing. So that's how dedicated he was to practicing. And I think he was a very single-minded individual in that he really wanted to be the best he could be.
I'm talking with writer and director John Scheinfeld about his new film, Chasing Train. It opens today at the Tivoli in Kansas City. In the mid-1950s, John, another giant picks him up, and that was Miles Davis. That worked for a while, but then Davis wound up firing Coltrane, too, over the same thing, same issue, the drug use?
Yes, as he just could not kick the habit, Coltrane. And the Miles Davis Quintet was arguably the top group in jazz at that time. So that's 1955 to 1957. And but as we got into 57, the drug use was starting to get in the way of the music. Coltrane wasn't playing as well. He would show up late. He would be irresponsible. And for Miles Davis, according to our scholars in the film, Ashley Kahn and Lewis Porter, both of whom wrote books about Coltrane, wonderful books, that was just too much for Miles. For Miles, it was all about the music. And if the music is suffering, you had to go. I don't think he wanted to get rid of Coltrane, but I think he felt this might be the wake-up call, and in fact, it proved to be precisely that. And that's actually where we open up our film. I love to it's all about storytelling and making a documentary. For me, it's all about storytelling. And so I like to tell it like a dramatic story. So we open at a crisis point in Coltrane's life. He's in the best band in the land, making good money, has a new wife, daughter, and he gets fired. What's he going to do? Is he going to go down the path that his hero, Charlie Parker, another iconic saxophone player, is he going to go down that road, which is to continue with the drugs and die a young death? Or is he going to get himself clean and achieve his potential? And that's what he chose to do. No secret there, so I'm not giving no spoiler alert for the film. But it's when he gives up the drugs that he sets out on the iconic path.
And so Miles Davis eventually brings him back into the band. In fact, John Coltrane was there for the recording of the most famous album in jazz history. That's Miles Davis's Kind of Blue that was released in 1959. Let's listen to a portion of the opening track on that album. This is from So What? You know, from there, John Coltrane would go on to form his classic quartet, one of the greatest in jazz history, with McCoy Tyner, Elvin Jones, and Jimmy Garrison. How did that band come together?
Well, much as Coltrane was a compulsive practicer, he also was, one could say, a compulsive band leader. He went out on his own in 1960, and he tried different combinations, different people on bass, different people on horns, different people on drums. And finally, about a year later, he hit upon this combination, and he felt this was right. And for the next 5 years, that was the classic quartet. They traveled the world, they traveled the country, and also made a number of significant albums. Although, Steve, you know, we've used the word jazz here a lot today.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting quote from Coltrane is, he says, I myself don't recognize the word jazz. I feel that I just play John Coltrane. And I think in many ways that's an important statement. He was very focused on advancing his vision. He was constantly pushing the envelope. He was constantly incorporating new sounds and new concepts into his music. In some ways, it was, to me, because I'm a rock, I grew up on rock and roll.
Mm-hmm.
It was a bit like the Beatles, where every album was different than the one that came before it.
Mm-hmm.
And with this quartet, he was able, as Sonny Rollins says in the film, he was able to fly. But I think he defies any genre, any one genre. I think he defies being pigeonholed in any way. So I would love for your listeners not to think of him as a jazz artist, but to think of him as an artist. And that's what we set out to do with Chasing Train, was to make a portrait of an artist. we're not analyzing the music. We're not talking about a history of jazz. What we're really doing is peeling away the layers of the onion to reveal the man that behind the art, and what were the influences, and we've talked about them here through your good questions. What were the influences that impacted him so that he was able to continue on this path?
You know, this notion, John, that he could fly with his playing, no question he played fast. In fact, his style became known as Sheets of Sound. It was so fast. Here's how John Densmore, the drummer for the Doors, recalled what it was like hearing John Coltrane play in his prime.
When I was 17, I was a jazz buff. I was well aware of rock and roll, but I considered jazz the higher art form. I had heard that Coltrane was coming to Shelley's Manhole in Hollywood. Saw them, oh, I don't know, 5 or 6 times. Unbelievable. I didn't know that Coltrane would be such an icon, but I sensed that I was witnessing magic. It would be just like Coltrane would be saying something on his tenor or soprano. Elvin would answer, and then we'd get all intertwined. And it was free. Whew. I mean, they still would come back to the tune and the chord changes, but they'd go out on the edge as far as they could. Very inspiring.
Man, what a great description of that music, John. You can't say it much better than that.
Now, well, John is brilliant, and he's brilliant in the film. And one of the reasons he's there is he saw Coltrane on stage, mm-hmm. and as a fan, not as a fellow musician. And I thought that's a wonderful perspective to have. And in fact, Steve, in deciding who I wanted to interview for Chasing Train, I really divided it into four categories. And I sort of go about it as if I'm casting a scripted feature film. I want different voices, different perspectives, different ways of expressing themselves. And so the first category we talked about a little bit earlier were people that knew Coltrane, so they could speak with credibility and legitimacy, so Sonny Rollins and all those other jazz legends. Then I also wanted family members because they give a more intimate window into the artist. And so we have four of his children in the film, one of whom, Antonia, his stepdaughter from his first marriage to Naima. She had never, ever given an interview about her father. Took me 4 months to persuade her to do that. But she tells wonderful stories that really help bring Coltrane alive. And that was really
including one story. Let me just cut you off, John, including one story about the night that John Coltrane walked home. I think instead of paying for a cab, because he wanted to use the money that he had just earned at the gig to buy his stepdaughter a pair of new shoes.
Yeah, it was such a wonderful story.
Yes,
and
yes.
She didn't think I was going to like the story because it was so small. And
it was a great story.
As a filmmaker, it's those kind of small stories that tell you big things about your subject. So it spoke to who he was as a man and who he was as a father. But then we have people like John Densmore, Carlos Santana, Common, Kamasi Washington, who are successful artists in their own right, who claim Coltrane as an inspiration. And then I always like to have a couple of unexpected people so that people like your listeners or yourself might say, what the heck are they doing in this movie? And Cornel West is one of those, and Bill Clinton is another.
How did you get Bill Clinton?
I'm sorry, Steve. With all of these voices, it really was working towards our goal of helping the audience to see Coltrane as a three-dimensional human being, not just the iconic photographs on the album covers.
How tough was it for you to get Bill Clinton?
Easy and extraordinarily difficult. I had reached out to his chief of staff early on, and we got a very fast response that said, oh, we think the president will find much joy in talking about John Coltrane for your film. And then it took us 10 months to get him. He was quite busy with his own schedule and, of course, campaigning for his wife. But it was last June, almost a year ago, I got a call on a Friday afternoon here in Los Angeles. And it was Tuesday, 2:30, New York. We'll see you there. It's like, okay. So hopped on the plane and we went to get him. And it was just a wonderful experience. I've interviewed a lot of famous people, but had that good fortune, but never interviewed a president before. And my wife, Karen, asked me, were you intimidated? And I said, you know, not at all. He made all of us on the crew feel very, very comfortable. Mm. And as soon as the camera started rolling, it was just like the two of us were Coltrane fans shooting the breeze about our hero, you know? And he was so eloquent on the subject of Coltrane, so passionate,
yes.
So thoughtful.
Yes.
Your audience will see in the film that he truly elevates the Coltrane conversation.
John Scheinfeld is my guest. He's the writer and director of a new documentary on John Coltrane. It opens today in Kansas City. It's titled Chasing Train. You know, John Coltrane wasn't political, but boy, he could make a statement. I want to play one of his most famous tracks. This is Alabama, written in response to the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing on September 15th, 1963, that killed four girls in Birmingham. Thank you. How was that song received, John?
I think then as now, it was received as a very powerful composition. As you said, he really did not speak publicly about his politics. In general, he was a quiet man. But he was so disturbed by the events of Birmingham that he was really compelled to write this piece. And I think today, as we see in the film, from Bill Clinton, who is of one generation, to Common, who's of another generation and another ethnicity, that composition enables them really to feel the emotion of the time. And I think that's one of the great things about this recording, but so many of Coltrane's, is that there's some kind of quality that differentiates him from other recording artists. Maybe it's the spiritual quality you spoke of earlier, but it's something that enables people to feel some emotional component that you don't always feel in music. And he wrote another piece a few years later called Peace on Earth, in which he was sort of a meditation about Japan and the atomic bomb mm-hmm. and the suffering of the Japanese people, and his meaning Coltrane, a personal plea for peace on earth. And that was the name of the composition, Peace on Earth. So he really had his eye on many different aspects of life and culture. And that, I think, also contributed to making him so unique as an artist.
You know, at some point in 1964, John Coltrane secludes himself in his garage at his house, and he goes to work on his masterpiece, A Love Supreme, an album that you've already alluded to today. What did his wife, Alice, recall about that time and how focused John Coltrane was?
Well, his wife is Alice Coltrane, who is a significant artist in her own right.
Yes.
They were married about a year, or together about a year at that point. And he had an idea, and he was so focused on bringing this idea to fruition that he went upstairs in their house, closed the door, came down for meals and to say hi to the kids, but largely was up there. And the timing varies. Some people say a week, some people say 10 days, some people say 2 weeks. But he was like a man on a mission. He was bound and determined to complete this work. And as Alice said in several interviews, when it was finished, he came down the stairs holding aloft this lead sheet with A Love Supreme, all the notes written down as they would be recorded. And she described him as like Moses coming down from the mountain, but instead of the Ten Commandments, he's got A Love Supreme.
Let's listen, John, to the opening track from A Love Supreme. This is Acknowledgement. You know, John, someone in the film talks about the audacity that John Coltrane had to speak to God through jazz, and I think you hear maybe a little bit of that in that track. John Scheinfeld is the writer and director of Chasing Train, a new documentary on John Coltrane opening today in Kansas City. John, what a pleasure to have you. Thanks so much.
Oh, happy to be here. Thanks for the interest.
Sports fans in Kansas City and beyond are generally a forward-thinking bunch. There's always next year, goes the rallying cry. But what keeps fans coming back for more is a healthy sense of history and, as commentator Victor Wishna explains in this week's A Fan's Notes, an occasional blast from the past.
If you were at Kauffman Stadium on Sunday, you could be forgiven for wondering what year this is. The Royals were sporting old Kansas City Monarchs jerseys, while many in the crowd arrived dressed to the nines in their dandiest duds, 1940s style, all part of a salute to the historic Negro Leagues. Of course, that's not the only reason to feel like we're in a time warp right now. Is that really the Royals' keep-the-line-moving lineup out there? Dead last in the league in hits, runs, and on-base percentage? And since when did opposing teams score after the sixth inning? What's going on here? Was 2015 really that long ago? It is said that those who forget the past are doomed to repeat it. But sports fans are meticulous chroniclers. Yes, sports are all about record-keeping, from the score, to wins and losses, to the all-time marks in every last statistical category. But more than that, like any worthy tradition, sports is rooted in the past. What happens now only matters because of what happened before, or didn't happen, or hasn't happened for a generation or more. Fans never forget. We honor the past, and, selectively, we hope to repeat it. Because retro doesn't necessarily mean regression. At the recent NFL draft, the Kansas City Chiefs selected a quarterback in the first round for the first time since 1983. That's more than 12 years before Patrick Mahomes II, the Texas Tech gunslinger the KC traded up to take with the 10th overall pick, was even born. It's awfully early yet, but reports from rookie camp reveal the Chiefs just might have their hardest and farthest throwing QB since, well, since anyone can remember. Researchers from Louisiana State and Australia's Queensland University found that enthusiasm for sports is firmly linked to remembrance of great games past, the excitement, the shared experience with friends and family, even how the grass smelled or the warm sun felt. As the pioneering sports marketer Bill Veeck observed back in 1965, it's the memories that keep sports fans coming back each season. That's why nostalgia-driven promotions are now standard at ballparks. No season would be complete without a retro night, or a party like it's 1985, or a Zubaz Palooza. Even oh-so-progressive Sporting KC, celebrating its 20th anniversary last year, was proud to break out its rainbow-striped, tech-fonted whiz jerseys from the distant 1990s. On Saturday, the Royals are back in town, and the first 20,000 fans at the K will be treated to a memorable moments bobblehead of pitcher Danny Duffy, allowing all of us to think back fondly on those moments in, say, 2016, when the team gave him some run support. And then, of course, we can look ahead. For all of its tradition, sports, ah yes, like life, is just a series of fleeting moments. And regardless of the year, a lot can change in a matter of days, weeks, and months. By the time the last homestand rolls around in September, the Royals may have gotten back on track, or, if trade rumors hold, bear a new look altogether. That final weekend is also when the team will honor its best minor league prospects in the ultimate theme promotion of the season. You guessed it, Futures Night.
Victor Wishin is a writer, editor, and sports fan. He lives in Leawood. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date, and you can follow me at Steve Kraske. On Monday's show, we speak with Paul Brandis of West Wing Reports, and we'll find out how weather whiplash is affecting our water. The great Bobby Watson composed our theme music. We had help this week from Linda Scher, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Coy Duggar. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.